Yes, thank you very much. And well, this is my son Leo here. Yay, yay. He likes me to introduce him. He says, like, Mom, are you going to introduce me this time? Yes, sure. So it's really special to be here for me, because I used to be a postdoc here at the Perimeter Institute. And actually, I was among the first bunch of postdocs in quantum information. And actually, my boy was born here. So it's a very special place for both of us. I had a really nice time when I was here, so a lot of good memories. So in a sense, it feels like home for me here. So what I want to do today, I want to tell you of some of the ideas of how you could use relativity to improve quantum measurement technologies. And yeah, I sort of like look at this. I just gave a talk at the IQC just now. And actually, if you were at my talk there, I apologize, because the beginning is just exactly the same, since it's the motivation to my whole research program. But I looked at that and I said, oh my God, I opened the IQC talk, but no, it's the right one. Okay, so I would like to start by thanking and acknowledging my group. So my postdocs and PhD students, project students, and this fantastic list of collaborators that have contributed to the results that I'm going to present today. So I would also like to thank my funding agency that has been very generous with us and has allowed me to put together this team. And if you want to know a bit more about what we do, I invite you please to visit our website. So the address is there. So what I'm going to do today, I'm going to start with a motivation. So that's going to be quite a long part of the talk. And I want to tell you why I think it's interesting and important that we look at relativistic effects in quantum information and quantum metrology. The talk today is going to focus on quantum metrology. And well, then I'll go into the technical tools. I'm not going to go into any detail there. I just want you to know what are the different ingredients involved in my research program. So I'll talk a little bit about quantum metrology, the covariance matrix formalism. Oh, hi. A face from those old times, Hillary. And then on quantum field theory, and how can you describe, use a BEC to probe space-time. Well, that's a bit more towards the results, but how can you describe quantum field theory in curved space-time using a BEC and a superconducting circuit? And then I will tell you the results. So basically, is that you can exploit relativity to improve in quantum measurement technologies. And I'll give you two examples. One of them will be an accelerometer. And my favorite one is a gravitational wave detector. So I'll show you that you can use a Bose-Einstein condensate to detect, hi, Rafael, a gravitational wave in a tabletop experiment. So I know that it's a very bold statement, so I'm very interested in hearing your feedback on that. And then if there's time, I'll tell you a little bit about our future work. So so as I said, I'll start with some motivation and background. So the quantum era is reaching relativistic regimes. So when I started my PhD in Imperial College, people were telling me, you know, the quantum, the sort of computers and so, the little pieces that we're using for transmission and information and so are reaching quantum regimes. So it's very important that we learn and understand how quantum properties could be affecting, for example, our computers and so on. And well, not just that, but this opens up the opportunity of exploiting quantum properties like entanglement and so on to do interesting things in the processing of information. So people were trying to convince me to start working in quantum information, and it worked, as you can see. And well, the other thing was that by people trying to use quantum systems to do new things like quantum teleportation or quantum computation, this would also be important in order for deepening our understanding of quantum theory. And it's really been amazing since people started to try to construct quantum computers, how many quantum systems have been explored and how deep our understanding of these systems have gone, sort of motivated by this task. So now, well, I'm very excited because I now can claim that the quantum era is reaching relativistic regimes. So again, we have these three reasons why it is important and interesting to understand what these relativistic effects are. So the first one would be practical aspects. Well, our quantum technologies could be affected by relativistic effects. So we need to understand what those effects are and learn how to correct them. And I'll tell you in the next slides why I'm saying this. But the most interesting one is that this is opening up the opportunity for us to actually exploit relativistic effects as well to do interesting things in the processing of information and in other quantum technologies. So as I said, today I'm going to focus on what can we do with relativistic effects to improve on quantum measurement technologies. And well, the most interesting thing that's occurring with quantum technologies reaching the relativistic regime is that, as I will show you, this will allow us to set up experiments that will allow us to deepen our understanding in the overlap of quantum theory and relativity. So when I was a postdoc here, actually, I started to work in the overlap of quantum information and relativity. We used to be in the old house that we call Times Square, back there, that office there. And we had a lot of interaction, the postdocs in quantum information and quantum gravity. And when I started to learn about general relativity more through their talks and through their work, I got really, really jealous. And at some point I thought, okay, I just want to swap fields. I'm glad that I didn't. I then end up doing something much more interesting, which was mixing them up. And back then I really had to sort of argue and try to convince people why this was an interesting thing to do or an important thing to do. I did get comments from people saying, like, wait a minute, I mean, we're just starting to understand how quantum information works, how quantum computation works. Slow down. I mean, why do you want to take this leap and start including relativity in the picture if we just don't understand the basic quantum information thing yet? And then what I was telling people is like, well, anyway, all the implementations of quantum computation and quantum communications are relativistic systems. I mean, take, for example, cavity QED, right? But all these implementations use photons. And there is no such thing as a non-relativistic approximation to a photon, right? Of course, we use aspects of the photon which are not relativistic, helicity. And that obviously works in the experiments. I'm not saying that all the experiments there are wrong. We have to be careful because we know from relativity that spin degrees of freedom and momentum are not really separable, but there's obviously a regime where this works. However, all of these objects are also relativistic. And what I was claiming back there is that we might be missing out on the opportunity of using these relativistic aspects of the physical systems to do very interesting things. But since then, my life has become much easier because these experiments have progressed from these tabletop experiments to these fantastic experiments, which are much now at much larger length scales. This is an experiment that took place in 2011 by the group led by Anton Seilinger, in which they distributed entanglement and demonstrated teleportation across two Canary Islands, so 144 kilometers. So these guys are moving very fast. So inspired on this, there is a number of projects at the moment that aim at taking quantum technologies to relativistic regimes, to space. So for example, the Space Quest project, also led by Anton Seilinger, that aims at distributing entanglement from the International Space Station. And well, the long-term aim is to set a global network for quantum cryptography. There's the Space Optical Clock Project that aims at taking quantum clocks to satellites to improve on GPS, and also, well, there are a number of interesting things that could be done around that, including improvements in astronomy and so on. There's many applications of that as well. There's a Quantus project that aims at taking quantum gases in space. People are working on taking Bose-Einstein condensates in space and making tests of microgravity and so on, testing the equivalence principle as well. But, well, we know that all of these, by the way, work with non-relativistic quantum mechanics. I mean, all of these experiments assume non-relativistic quantum mechanics as the main theoretical background. So, well, we know from GPS that at the regimes where satellites operate, we need to make corrections due to general relativity. So the GPS that we have in our phones, in our cars, operates with the precision of meters, sometimes even centimeters. And in order for GPS to have this precision, it needs to make corrections due to general relativity. So then the obvious questions that comes about is like, well, how are the quantum properties of these technologies affected by motion, by gravity, by the curvature of space-time? And this is, of course, very interesting questions just from the fundamental point of view. So that's what my research has really been about, by understanding how quantum properties, like entanglement, are affected by motion, by the curvature of space-time, by the dynamics of space-time. Sometimes I try to answer very practical questions. Sometimes, I don't know, my first paper is called Alice Falls into a Black Hole with Rob Mann. It was much more academic. This is the question that has interested me always, because people, when I learned about quantum teleportation, would say Alice and Bob meet at some point in space-time. Sorry, at some point. I always like have now space-time in my brain. So then they separate, and then they do quantum teleportation. But what if they separate in the presence of the gravitational field like the Earth? What happens if space-time is perturbed, if it's dynamic? What happens if they move at relativistic speeds? So all these questions have always interested me very, very much. So quantum metrology is a field that has developed in parallel, let's say, to quantum information. They're like brothers and sisters, I would say. So the main idea in quantum metrology is to use quantum properties, again, like entanglement, or quantum states, like squeeze states, to improve in measurement technologies. So the main idea there is that you have a parameter that plays a role in your Hamiltonian, or your state, which depends on a given parameter, could be temperature. And quantum metrology gives you techniques to find out what is the best strategy that you could use to estimate this parameter. So this is giving rise to the new generation of quantum measurement technologies and their very interesting proposals for quantum clocks, for a number of sensors, including gravimeters magnetometers, or so on. And as I said, there is an interest in taking these quantum technologies, these sensors, these clockers, to satellites where relativity starts to kick in. Now, another very important part of quantum metrology is using quantum metrology to measure parameters that are relevant in quantum general relativity. So, for example, the strength of the gravitational field. So why this is important? You can build an accelerometer or a gravimeter. And if you find little changes in the gravitational field, this could tell you that there's oil underneath, or that there's diamonds, or it could be useful for detecting earthquakes. And also to explore scientific questions, like if you could probe space-time with with a lot of precision, this could tell you about maybe deviations from general relativity. So there is a lot of interest in doing that. So far the proposals are out there, I'm not entirely happy with them. Some of them use non-relativistic quantum mechanics, like with a BEC, and they consider gravity to be a Newtonian. And this, of course, works, but in a very, very limited regime. So, for example, the experiment of Wineland, in which he has a quantum clocks and he puts them at different heights, he finds effects due to time dilation already in a meter. So you can see how these approaches are very, very limited. Then other groups do something that I feel even more uncomfortable with, which is they make corrections to the proper time due to general relativity. But we know that non-relativistic quantum mechanics and general relativity are incompatible. So I'm not saying that their proposals are wrong, but again, they're very limited to this very precise, this is very specific regime. And what I'm trying to do now is I want to build all the tools and techniques that will allow us to go beyond those regimes. So how do you do that? Well, you now move to quantum field theory in curved space-time. So this is not quantum gravity, but it is an intermediate step. So it's a semi-classical theory in that you take consider space-time to be classical, and then you put quantum fields on it. So it incorporates Lorentz invariants, and it allows you to bring together quantum effects and relativity in a compatible way at low energy scales. But those are energy scales that are compatible with these regimes where satellites operate. So this seems to be the next natural step to take when we want to talk about processing information and making quantum measurement technologies. So, the famous predictions of quantum field theory in curved space-time are the Hawking radiation, the Unruh effect, the dynamical Casimir effect, and particle creation due to the expanding universe. And many of these are now being implemented in analog gravity systems that I'll tell you a little bit more about those in a moment. And the dynamical Casimir effect was demonstrated by Chris Wilson, that you probably know, who's now in the IQC, and Perel Delsing, who I'm collaborating with both of them. They're demonstrating some of the experiments that I proposed in their laboratories. But that was more about the talk that I gave previously. So now, if you promote things and you move to quantum field theory in curved space-time and start looking at quantum information and quantum metrology, what kind of things could you do? Well, we were talking about possible corrections, quantum technologies, typical protocols for quantum information like quantum teleportation or quantum cryptography being maybe affected by relativistic effects. So these two papers are studies of quantum information and quantum cryptography in these sort of relativistic regimes. And what we show is that motion, gravity, and the curvature of the space time of the Earth can have effects on the fidelity of teleportation or on quantum cryptography. So I think that these studies are important for people who are interested in putting quantum technologies in space. They need to be aware how, for example, the motion of the satellites or the curvature of the gravitational field of the Earth could affect their technologies. And they're, of course, small effects, but if we're interested in very high precisions, they might become important. And this is sort of the part of the research that I find the most boring, because it's about sort of corrections. And what I'm trying to do is more like innovation and how can we do like things that you cannot do. But, well, this was a starting point, and this has allowed us to learn a lot of things that happen and develop more intuition. But as I said, what I'm really interested is what can we do that it's new? So we want to develop the new generation of gravimeters, clocks, and so on, that not only exploit quantum properties, but also relativistic effects, and that are compatible with the notion of space-time. And then what I want to do is sort of turn things around and use these technologies to deepen our understanding of the overlap of general relativity and quantum mechanics. So I'm going to show you a little bit today what I mean by that. So quantum mechanics and general relativity are the two more fundamental theories that we have in nature. And we know that they work very well in their respective regimes of applicability. Quantum mechanics works very well in very small length scales, general relativity in the large scale. And well, you all know here that the holy grail of physics is to be able to bring these two theories in a compatible way. And that's the aim of quantum gravity. And in quantum gravity, we generally start with general relativity and go to very small length scales where you would expect quantum effects to show up. And one of the problems with these theories is that there is no experiments to guide the theory. And this I see as a big problem. I mean, usually in physics, many of the breakthroughs have come thanks to the interaction between experiment and theory. But now take it the other way around. Start with quantum mechanics and take these quantum mechanical experiments at larger and larger length scales. So that's what's happening at the moment. And that's really beautiful because that's going to allow us to really make experiments that will allow us to understand deeper things of the overlap of these two theories. And hopefully we could develop that very needed intuition on how to bring them together. So, but again, in order to be able to do that, we need to not just work with non-relativistic quantum mechanics when we're talking about, you know, these experiments in space, but we need to upgrade the theory to quantum field theory in curved space-time. So this is what we have been doing, and this is an example of a proposal for an experiment using satellites, nanosatellites, that allow us to test some of the effects of gravity and motion on quantum entanglement. So I'm not going to talk about that today, but maybe if this question interests you, you can have a look at that. The New Scientist liked our proposal and include our proposal in a cover article, which is about this sort of topics. Okay, so now technical tools. So let me see, how am I doing with time? So quantum metrology. So I as I was saying, quantum metrology is about using quantum properties to improve in quantum measurement technologies. Leo, did you steal the hockey? Yeah, there he is. I saw him playing with it and I said, he's hiding it somewhere. So so we have a, for example, a Hamiltonian that depends on a parameter, could be time. And you want to estimate that parameter with high precision. So what quantum metrology gives you is a strategy in which it helps you find what is the ideal state in which you could prepare your quantum system and what are the best measurements that you can make on your system to estimate, for example, that parameter that, again, the example is time. So you find this optimal strategy using the Fisher information. So the Fisher information depends on this fidelity. So basically, you take a quantum state that depends on your parameter at time, and then you compare it with the same quantum state with an infinitesimal increment in your parameter, and you compare the states to the fidelity. So if the states are very, very, very similar, then you won't be able to estimate the parameter with high precision. In the measure in which these two states are more distinguishable, then you will get a better estimate in the parameter. So this is what the Fisher information captures, and this is the main figure of merit that we use in quantum metrology. So how do you now use quantum metrology in quantum field theory in curved spacetime? So as I said, in quantum metrology, one is interested in estimating parameters from non-relativistic the quantum mechanics from your Hamiltonian. But now, if we apply quantum metrology to quantum field theory in curved spacetime, we will be able to estimate parameters which are relevant in quantum field theory. So what could be those parameters? Accelerations, proper times, gravitational field strength, the amplitude of a gravitational wave, that's what I'm going to show you today. What else could be interesting? We made some proposals how to measure the Unruh effect using these techniques and so on. So, the other ingredient is simply quantum field theory curves space-time. So for example, I mean, most of our work can be generalized to the electromagnetic field, to Dirac fields,
and so on, but we usually always start with the simplest case, which is the scalar field. And well, we have the Klein-Gordon equation, but that invariance depends on the space-time metric that, of course, can be curved. And when we have a time-like hidden vector field, we can quantize the field by associating creation and annihilation operators to our solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. So as an example, we might be interested in quantizing the state of the field inside a cavity. So there we have a localized relativistic quantum field. So we have the Klein-Gordon equation here. I assume that my cavity is just one-dimensional. So this is a wave equation. You find the solutions to that, which are plane waves. You impose boundary conditions. So that takes your exponentials into the sine functions. And that as well makes your spectrum discrete. And then you associate creation and annihilation operators to your solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. And you can describe the states of the field inside the cavity. The vacuum is, as always, defined as a state which is annihilated by the annihilation operators. And then you can define particles by acting on the vacuum with creation operators. So you might be interested as well as describing the state of the field in a cavity undergoing a motion. So then you would go to Rinder coordinates, which are an appropriate choice of coordinates for uniformly accelerated observers, and you would get the Klein-Gordon equation to be again a plane, a wave equation, but now in Rinder coordinates, and you basically follow the same procedure and quantize your field inside a uniformly accelerated cavity. You might be interested in requiring that from the perspective of an observer moving with the cavity, the length of the cavity is constant. So Gugolyubov transformations play an important role in quantum field theory in curved space-time, because they allow you to calculate how the field would look like, say, from the perspective of different observers. So if you're in flat space-time, you might say that inertial observers see the quantum vacuum, but then it becomes interesting to describe the state of the field from the perspective of uniformly accelerated observers. So there is a Gugolyubov transformation that relates the modes of the uniformly accelerated observer with the modes with the inertial observer. And you can calculate the state of the field from the uniformly accelerated observer. And since there is a region of space-time which is causally disconnected to that observer, the observer would see thermal particles. So that's the Unruh effect. Well, in the expansion of the universe, for example, you would start in the vacuum, and then the space-time changes, and then you would relate sort of the modes in the past infinity and the future infinity using a Gugolyubov transformation as well. Here, the coefficients, these alpha coefficients, tell you about mode mixing. So excitations in the different modes could swap from one mode to another, and betas are related to particle creation. So a typical example of quantum field theory in curved space-time would be particle creation, so these betas, due to the expansion of the universe. So also any space-time dynamics could be also captured in these Gugolyubov transformations. And in particular, it would tell you about this moving cavity. So if you have a cavity, and then you take it through any trajectory that you want, the final state of the field you can find by a Gugolyubov transformation. What has allowed me to bring together these fields, quantum metrology, quantum information, and quantum field theory in curved space-time, has been the covariance matrix formalism. So the covariance matrix formalism is very much used in quantum optics because it's applicable when you have a finite number of modes, of bosonic modes. And when you restrict your analysis to Gaussian states, all the information of the state of the system you can encode in the first moments. So these are the generalized position and momentum given in terms of the creation and annihilation operators of the different modes. And these are the first momentums. And this is the covariance matrix, which encodes second momentums. And when the states are Gaussian, you can use this equivalent description instead of using the density matrix, you could describe your states in the covariance matrix, you know, the covariance matrix in the first moment, and then the transformations on your states are going to be encoded in a symplectic matrix. So this would play the role of the unitary transformation. This matrix satisfies this condition. This is the symplectic form, where the symplectic form has information about the commutation relations of your field operators. So one of the things that we did is that we just sort of rewrote the dynamical Casimir effect in terms of in this language. So there is some work done on that already. We kind of, some of that, we repeated, say, in a different way or in a different formalism, so we could apply the tools for quantum information in quantum metrology. So what we have really contributed there is the application of quantum technique, of quantum information in quantum metrology tools. So in particular, we did so with a cavity undergoing any kind of motion that we want. So I have until 5:30, right? Okay, so just checking more time. Okay, so what have we done recently? Well, one of the things we wanted to do was to build a general framework for what we now call relativistic quantum metrology. So basically, we wanted to provide people interested in doing work on this field with a number of formulas in which they could just, you know, you have a relativistic quantum field. So this could be, for example, your cavity, and you would want to estimate a parameter that's relevant. Could be the acceleration of the cavity, for example, and then you build an accelerometer. So we wanted to provide simply the formulas that you give me the Bobolikov coefficients that depend on the parameter that you want to estimate, and just plug the Bobolikov coefficients into our formula, and we tell you what is the Fisher information associated to your scheme. So that's the parameter you want to estimate. So we did that for a single mode states and two mode states. So you imagine that all your modes are in the vacuum except for two. They're the ones that, or one, that's the one that interests you. Then this mode goes on transformation because the universe expanded, because you moved the cavity, or whatever you want, and we give you the formulas. And now I will show you how, from very now simple calculating Bobolikov coefficients for different interesting physical situations, you can build a, you can construct or design a number of measurement devices which are very interesting, like gravimeters and so on. So let me show you some examples. Before that, just so you get a flavor of how new this is, I guess the first work I did actually here at the Perimeter Institute that I did that could be connected with that is that, we showed that you could use entanglement to estimate the expansion parameters of the universe. And this was not quantum metrology because we don't use the techniques of quantum metrology, we don't use Fisher information. It is, in a sense, just showing that you can actually use quantum properties to estimate parameters that show up in quantum field theory in curved spacetime. So I think this was the first thing that we did without really noticing in that direction. Then much more of what we would already call relativistic quantum metrology was in 2010 with my colleague Gerard Valdeso in Nottingham and a student that was working with him. We showed that you could use phase estimation techniques, so this is again quantum metrology, to measure the Unruh effect at accelerations much orders of magnitude lower than the proposals that were around in those days. Then there is a paper by Tori Dowds and Milburn and Case in which they're interested in finding what are the limits in measuring space-time parameters imposed in a fundamental way by quantum theory. So to what sort of interesting physical situations could you apply all this theory? Well, one of them is on a Bose-Einstein condensate. So let me explain a little bit of how this works. So in a Bose-Einstein condensate, you have around, 10 to the 6 atoms cooled to the ground state. So if you could cool all the atoms to the ground state and assume that they don't collide or there's no interatomic interactions, then you could describe everything with a mean field function. So this obeys the Gross-Pisayevsky equation, and well, you give the usual treatment. So when people describe a Bose-Einstein condensate, they never do it in a relativistic setting, because for most experiments, this is totally irrelevant. So if you wanted to describe the BC in space-time, it would be a bit like trying to kill a fly with a bullet, or I don't know what's the expression in English. I think I'm translating that from Spanish. But okay, so the atoms are collide, so you can't cool them all to the ground state. So because they collide, there's always some quantum fluctuations on top of the bulk of the BC. So that's the bulk of the BC. And you always have these quantum fluctuations, or little sort of wiggles on top of the bulk of the BC. And those obey a Klein-Gordon equation on an effective metric. That's curved. So this is how the effective metric looks like. So this is the density of the bulk of the BC. So it's basically phi dagger phi. This is the effective speed of sound on the BC. This is the real space-time metric. And this is what I call the analog gravity metric. So it also depends on the speed of sound. This is, of course, the speed of light. And these are velocity flows on the BC. So Bill Undrew proposed that we could use analog systems to test interesting things about space-time. It's really very, very unlikely that we will do experiments with black holes. So he had this very nice idea that we might be able to use other physical systems to create horizons and so on. So this is the field of analog gravity. So in analog gravity, there's also very nice work on how could you use a BC due to these situations we just described to just simulate space-time things. So for example, can we test in an analog system, in a BC, that there is particle creation due to the expansion of the universe? So what people do is that they consider this to be flat and they neglect it. And then what they do is that they play with this metric to simulate space-time. So for example, Jeff Steinhauer in Israel has a sonic black hole in his laboratory, and he's starting to detect some of the particles, like Hawking radiation. It's work in progress. Chris Westbrook in France is working with the expanding universe. So you play with the speed of sound or with the density to simulate this expanding universe. So they have very nice results. So what we did is something a bit crazy. We said, what happens if we do it the other way around? If we make a requirement that this part there is flat, would real space-time changes, perturbations, produce observable effects on a Bose-Einstein condensate? Uli thought, okay, this is a crazy idea, it cannot work. We have all the tools and techniques to explore this, so just let's go ahead and just put in some numbers and see what happens. And oh my God, the result is amazing. We found that, well, at least, you know, in the ideal case, you can detect gravitational waves using this, and I'll show you how. So let's, I'm first going to show you how to build an accelerometer, and then I'll go into the gravitational wave. But let's say first that you say that the space-time of the underlying, the real space-time metric is flat. So the analog gravity, no, the effective metric of the phonons would take this form. So you see, it looks very much like the flat metric, only that you replace the speed of sound here instead of the speed of light, and it has this conformal factor. So if you make this change of variables, you actually recover the standard flat space-time metric. So if you look at here, what's happening is that basically the phonons sort of have the time for phonons flow differently, and what that makes is that it makes the effects of the real space-time metric amplified in a way. So that's what's at the heart of the trick of what happens. The thing is that in a BC, the spectrum of the phonons have this form. So you have the speed of sound here. And as you will see in the gravitational wave detector, this is at the heart of how this gravitational wave detector works, because these modes of the VEC are in resonance with gravitational waves. So people ask me, how is it possible that you take a, that you say that instead of using LIGO, which is kilometers big, you can do, you can detect the gravitational waves in something very small. In LIGO, the relevant parameter is delta L over L. If you calculated that in our setting, you would laugh. It's ridiculous. But that plays no relevance in our proposal, because our proposal is based on quantum resonance, and I'll show you more details about it. So anyway, you can find the you have your VEC in a box. You impose boundary conditions in this metric, and you find the solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, and you quantize your field. So, as I said before, the gravitational wave detector, I show you how to build an accelerometer. So, consider that the VEC is all the modes are in the vacuum. That's not entirely realistic, but we'll talk about what happens in more realistic situations in a moment. Then take two modes of the VEC and prepare them in a two-mode free state. Now, accelerate the VEC. After it accelerated, you can make a measurement on the new state, and from that, using quantum metrology, you're able to estimate the acceleration of the VEC. So how it works is here, this parameter depends on the acceleration that we want to estimate, so we assume that parameter to be small, and we plug it in into our formulas to calculate the Bogoliubov coefficients. So we calculate the Bogoliubov coefficients, we plug them in the general framework formulas that I showed you, and there pops out our accelerometer, which has the potential of improving on the current set proposals for accelerometers several orders of magnitude. So let me tell you what I'm comparing with. So the state of the art would be a Bose-Einstein condensate treated in a non-relativistic quantum mechanical way. It's treated like a big quantum particle, and then it's dropped. And with that, you can measure, say, g, so the acceleration, right? The Fisher information in that case depends basically on the time of flight. So you basically let this fall for some time, and then you can estimate the precision. This works amazingly well. It has an incredible precision. But as I said, this is just going, it works with Newtonian gravity, and some people make these corrections due to general relativity. But this is going to work just in a very limited regime. The other thing is, like, because it depends on the time of flight, well, they cannot make them very, very small. The smallest gravimeters or accelerometers like this need to let the VEC fall 15 centimeters, which is already amazing. But I claim that our technology will allow us to miniaturize the accelerometers into a chip, because ours doesn't depend on the time of flight, so we don't have that constraint. Well, anyway, using this, the Fisher information in this case is of this order. And now we take similar numbers as the one that they have, and we can improve in two orders of magnitude here. The other thing that I like about this proposal is that what we're using is particle creation, which is a relativistic effect. So actually, this accelerometer is based on length contraction. Because if you were Galilean, you were using Galilean transformations, all different observers would see the same length of the VEC, and there would be no particle creation. So what's really what we're really exploiting is length contraction and particle creation due to that.
What is it that the other people measure? You said they drop the...
They drop the VEC, and they say they do absorption imaging as well as in our proposal. So they count the number of atoms in each mode.
And the number changes depending on the acceleration? Is
it? So the state of the atoms pick up a phase due to the drop. So every atom picks up a phase that they can measure due to the fall of the BEC. And the precision goes like the time of like.
So they do some sort of interference between the groups?
What
is it that they
They have an interferometer.
What is, what is it they actually measure?
So what they do is that they take the 10 to the 6 atoms and they prepare it. They use the internal states of the atom. So they the state of the atom is prepared in 0 plus 1. And then as they fall, so it's an interferometer, the 1 picks up a phase that depends on the on G. And then they recombine the BC and they measure. And that's how they estimate G. So in our case, you would have the same physical setting, but instead of treating it as one big quantum particle and doing it with non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you take the phonons on top of the BC, which are a relativistic quantum field, and then you drop it and you estimate G by looking at how the correlations in your phonons change. So at the end, the measurement is the same. You need to do absorption imaging and count the number of atoms in each mode, but you would be able to see how that changed due to the change from being non-inertial and inertial. But that's something that, in that way, we haven't finished the calculation yet. This is sort of comparing with just taking into account an acceleration. The setting that I just did needs a little bit more the work. Okay, so let me go into the gravitational wave detector. So now we have the metric of a gravitational wave to be the flat metric plus the small perturbation. So this metric here, we take this form. If we now plug this metric into the effective metric that the phonons feel, you get this metric here. So you have the speed of sound there. And we're interested, just to keep things easy for the first calculation, on just a one-dimensional trap, which is actually we're working already with experimentalists, and it's not a problem to make a one-dimensional box in a PC. So in that case, the metric takes this form. And the perturbation on the metric, the gravitational wave, is modeled, like it is in many, many gravitational waves, as just a sine function. This is the amplitude of the gravitational wave, and this is the frequency of the gravitational wave. And that's the important thing, is that one needs to prepare a BC using modes that are close to this, because then they're going to resonate, and then you will be able to see how the correlations between these two modes change. So we calculated the Bobolyubov coefficients with the box without gravitational wave, and then after the gravitational wave went by, we plug them into our formulas, and we get the Fisher information, which is, you can even get an exact analytical a formula for that. Well, then we plugged in numbers, and we get amazing results. So for example, if you have the Bose-Einstein condensate, usually they can live for like a second or so, and then you do absorption imaging. In the ideal case, so now I want to talk about also the non-ideal case. In the ideal case, you would get the precision of LIGO in one go. Now, there is such thing as a Bose-Einstein machine, which allows you to prepare a new Bose-Einstein condensate all the time. And the state of the art there's papers from the best groups working on this, claim that they can do integration times for a year. If you were able to integrate for a year in our setting, you would be able to go 4 orders of magnitude beyond what LIGO is doing. So, well, as I said, this is an ideal calculation in several ways. One is that the Fisher information tells you that there is an ideal measurement that will allow you to achieve these orders of magnitude. Now we're doing the calculation using absorption imaging, which is the easy measurement procedure to do in the laboratory. We're also looking at some other measurement procedures, which involve another scheme that we worked on, which is putting impurities into the BEC to measure the state of the BEC without having to destroy the BEC. We haven't used entanglement yet, which has the potential of still improving on that. So there's going to be a motion like this where we start putting some of the calculations in the, with considering all possible sources of noise. It's going to reduce these fantastic numbers, of course. But on the other hand, we haven't exploited all the tricks from quantum metrology, like entanglement, that will now also allow to improve. So ask me in a year, and I don't know after we do all these analyses, where we're going to end. At the moment, we're working with experimentalists in feasibility tests. One of the calculations that my students are doing at the moment is that they're looking at finite temperature, because this is an important source of noise. So a BEC can never really be cooled to the ground state. There will always be a finite temperature. And what this temperature does is that it can blur your signal. So what the calculation that we're doing will tell us is how cold the Bose-Einstein has to be in order for you to detect this. We made some back-of-the-envelope calculations, and it looks like the number of thermal phonons at these frequencies is very low, so in reality we're not too worried, but we will be able after this calculation to tell experimentalists what is it that they have to do in order to detect how cold they have to be. So there's a number of other like realistic calculations that we're doing, but this is just the beginning of this. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done in order to make the calculation more and more realistic, but I just think that the proof of principle calculation is very, very promising. And not only because of the gravitational wave detector, it's because what you can do with this technology. Basically, we are designing a little device, a quantum device, that will allow you to probe space-time. So we're looking at how to use this device to measure space-time parameters of the Earth. So for example, those radio radius, and I think this could have potential of improving on GPS, because if you know the space-time parameters of the Earth, you could make better calculations of GPS and improve on that. And we're also thinking about how to use this device for navigation. When you go under the ocean with a submarine, you don't have any more GPS signal, so then it becomes interesting to build accelerometers, but because of the equivalence principle, you cannot distinguish between uniform acceleration and the accelerometer, so these devices need what's called a gravity map. So we have some ideas on how to build sort of a device that will allow you to navigate under these circumstances in this fully quantum field theory curved space. And so somehow the curvature of space time is naturally embedded in these technologies. So this is from the, I have some other ideas, but I think I will prefer just to leave it there, and just if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
So if you have a question for Yvette, feel free to ask them.
Yes.
So in this gravitational wave detector, it requires resonance, so it's something like a quantum version of the old Weber bar something
exactly.
Like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So what, but that's designed, that was designed to have a sensitivity at a frequency, a particular frequency, limited by the mechanical size and so on, and stiffness and so on. So what is the frequency range that you can get with this proposal?
Well, the numbers in the paper are from 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5.
Hertz, I see.
But you can extend this. So what do we have here to play with? It's kind of funny because I didn't know about that device until I finished that. And then people told me, oh, you didn't know that there were some ideas on how to use these resonators. How come those didn't work and this works? Well, because they were classical. Here we're going to very, very cold matter in the quantum regime where sensitivities are much higher. Now, the other thing is saying you're playing with resonances, so you have to tune your BEC to be in resonance. And how do you do that? Well, you can play with the length of the cavity, but you also have the speed of sound in your modes. So you could also change the effective speed of sound on your BEC, and that you can do by interacting with fields, flashback resonances. So all of that you could use to tune your gravitational wave detector. Now, just because it's a baby calculation, we just got started, we're just using two modes of the BEC, but in principle, you could use different frequencies of the BEC and take advantage of those, because you could say, what if I'm off resonance? And then you could have, of course, many BECs, all of them tuned at different frequencies in order to
Can you slow it down so that you can go down to kilohertz or something like that? Maybe someone will know better, but I think most of the realistic sources are kilohertz or less.
So the expert in the numbers is my postdoc, because he's the one who has been plugging all the things. And I remember him saying that you could go to the order of hertz, but I don't remember. I don't remember exactly what is that you compensate on. I think that you need to do with the BEC, which has a size. The size of the cavity, that it's a little bit difficult to handle for the experimentalists, but then that becomes an experimental challenge. Mm-hmm. But I think you can playing with the length and playing with the speed of sound on the BEC, you can play with the regimes that your device would be sensitive to. But I think the range is quite promising. But I can check,
one might worry that it's a small thing and speed of sound might be very fast, that you might get high frequencies more easily than the lower ones.
Mm-hmm.
But you say you might be able to go down to hertz.
Yes, I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but let me look at the details, because at the moment I don't remember what is, like, for example, if you try to go to hertz, then I remember there was an experimental complication, which had to do with having a BC that was probably difficult to produce at that length. But it didn't seem impossible either. And of course, all of this is, what I'm trying to say here is, like, the usual interferometers for measuring gravitational waves have been going on there for 30 years. They have taken a lot of money. Many groups are working on that. So we want a little bit of money to, you know, develop this idea and see where it goes. Yeah.
I very much hope that it works, because it would be fantastic. But I have a question. Could you show that slide again where you have the metric, the effective metric of the BEC proportional to the space-time metric and some correction?
I went too fast.
Right, this one.
Yeah.
So, graduate.
Okay,
this one. The arrow points to the metric here, the real space-time metric there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the case of flat space-time, I believe I have a rough idea how that orbit is derived, and that makes a lot of sense. But then, how do we know that when we go to curved space-time, this is really the curved space-time metric that enters here? Normally you could say, well, I just covariantize it, I make it generally relativistically covariant, so I go from the special relativist, from special relativity metric to the general relativity metric. But in this case, we're breaking the symmetries of space-time, because we have the rest frame of the BEC simply it out. So I think it's non-trivial that we can go here from the flat metric to simply plugging in the actual curved space-time metric. How do we see that we can do?
So you say that you cannot, I mean, this work is not my work, this is the actresses. So this is Matt Bizar and the group with Stefano Liberati.
Mm-hmm.
So they are the ones who write this with the general curve measure.
The general curve?
Yeah. Yes. And that, well, it's a quite lengthy paper, which how you start is really, really beautiful. I really love their work. How they start is with hydrodynamics and special relativity and so on. And that is at the basis of that paper is by Matt Bizar, and he shows
mm-hmm.
you that, that it doesn't just work with a flat case.
But isn't that surprising? Because doesn't that mean that the BEC, on one hand, has analog gravity, so it has internal dynamics which can mimic the effects of gravity. But of course, the BEC, when exposed to strong gravity, will also be affected by that. And what you seem to be showing here is that you can perform experiments that are more sensitive to the actual space-time curvature than to the analog.
I'm not saying that at all.
But are you saying that
The analog effects are much stronger than these effects. Like if I apply quantum metrology to the effects done here, those are much easier to detect. So what you can do is you can go into a frame in which these are, you can make them flat. I never said that. And actually, one of the things that we just finished the paper that I think should come up in the archive next week is we actually left it one flat, like everybody does, and we wrote an analog gravity paper, and we showed how to do a gravitational wave with the analog gravity thing, and all those waves are much bigger. Why were we interested in that? Because as a preparation for the real space type thing, because this you can control and you can play with and you can see, you know, learn from it. So there's this special issue on quantum simulations on a journal, and we got asked to write something, and we thought, oh, okay, we have the real gravitational wave thing, but let's do an analog one. And those effects you have a handle on them, so you can make them, big.
But can you also make them so small that they don't disturb your measurement of the degree?
Well, that is one of the things that we're doing at the moment. So here, one of the ingredients that is in the ideal situation is that you can distinguish between these and make this one flat. But well, we'll tell you really soon how that goes. But yeah, we're doing a number, and actually what we're having a lot of fun is that we're going everywhere and we're just talking, you know, making a list of everybody says, so what, finite temperature, okay, we'll look at that. And so that is one of the things we're also sort of looking at. For example, what accuracy can you make this one flat, or don't make it flat, let it be the smallest thing that it can be, and see how, if you can still distinguish sort of the different effects. But I tell you what's at the heart of it and why we think it's not a problem. Because let's say that you have little fluctuations here, right? That's what worries you, that you have a little fluctuation here. That's not gonna resonate with the gravitational wave. So it's going to be there, it's going to produce some noise, but it's not gonna resonate with the gravitational wave, and you will be able to distinguish the signals.
What? I hope it works.
Yeah.
Yeah, another question
on that. So you are trying to take advantage of the macroscopic wave function, which LIGO and so on, they don't. They look at classical mirrors and...
So you mean this?
Yeah,
this
the microscope.
One.
Yeah,
so
which Bose-Einstein condensation.
Yeah, but actually that one we're not using. Because I don't think the gravitational wave, and that's another calculation that we're doing, I don't think the gravitational wave changes this at all. And if it did, there's your gravitational wave detector. It's actually easier to make a gravitational wave detector with that, but it's not gonna change. It's like you would need a lot of energy to change that. So what we're using are the phonons, the quantum fluctuations.
Sure,
that's what you meant.
But,
okay.
But you need a macroscopic wave function in the background.
Yes.
I just wanted to point out that in the phenomenology of quantum fluids, even at finite temperature, as long as the macroscopic wave function remains, somehow we can ignore normal fluids, which is in the background. If the macroscopic wave function alone is disturbed,
If the macroscopic wave function is disturbed, that's a gravitational wave detector. Because a gravitational wave detector is going to be anything that's disturbed by the gravitational wave.
So why didn't people, or why didn't you think about standard superconductor or standard helium-4 superfluid, which are also macroscopic quantum states? Are there any problem with them?
No, because I know the physics of this very well. So just because for me it's easy, but if you have any suggestion of another physical system that we might be able to use, please let me know. I mean, it's out of my ignorance that I just use this one because this is the one I know well. Deep reason. I mean, what we really need is something that has sort of that slows down light. So at the moment, I'm also talking to Chris Wilson, who has superconducting circuits, that I'm working with him, and we're looking at how could we try to implement that in a superconducting circuit. And of course, it's much, much, much more difficult because the natural modes there don't resonate with those gravitational waves. So we're looking at possibilities there. And basically, it all has to do with slowing down light. We need a medium that slows down that light, and the Bose-Einstein condensate naturally does it, but any other quantum fluid would probably do the trick as well.
Because you have very wide parameter ranges in quantum fluids.
Yes, if you can point out into some reference or so, we would be very happy to look into that. Yeah, thanks.
Before I ask about getting lower frequencies, now I want to ask about getting higher frequencies. Because, I've thought for a while, I won't go into the reasons, but there should be some gravitational counterpart of the CMB. In other words, a sort of, gas of gravitons instead of photons. With the ordinary kind of gravitational wave detectors, it's completely hopeless to measure any of those.
Mm-hmm.
Many different reasons, but one is that they're very high frequency. So I suppose we're talking about, gigahertz or a little more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any hope of measuring at those higher frequencies?
I don't know. I haven't explored that. I should write these things down.
Okay.
You're giving me a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
I don't know the answers that because we've been focusing on the other ends, somehow. So on the top of my head, I don't know how
much. This would be like a stochastic background, but they would presumably be in the very narrow, relatively narrow frequency range.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
It would be great if there was some technique for,
looking for
something like that.
It sounds like you could give me some good, parameters where it could be interesting to see if our device can be tuned to those regimes. That's great. And also maybe some sources of noise could be more important in some regimes than in others. And all of that, I'm presenting a baby here, right? We have so much work to do. All of these questions, and so we haven't answered yet.
Probably the baby's working hard.
The baby's working hard. Yeah. So it was funny. He was making notes on my talk the other day, and he said he really likes my talk. And he wrote, "Mom, his talk was about quantum mechanics," and he wrote a bit of some Bell states there. It's very funny. Yeah, thanks very much.